Hey.
What up, Sean?
What's good, bro?
What's poppin', Swan?
Let me check.
Dime a ver, ¿qué lo que?
What's up, man?
What it do, baby?
What's up, Guan, my dudes?
Hey, y'all.
Hey, bye, you good?
Wagwan.
Yeah, what's good, yo?
Yo, what's good?
Hey, my guy, how you doing?
What the vibe is about to say? Come back, eh?
What's up?
Hey, friend.
Where's it seen?
Yo.
Senu Yage.
What it do, baby?
Sak passe.
Yo, what's good?
What it guan?
Yo. What's good?
What's up, Joe? What you on?
Here.
Que lo que?
What's good, guys?
Que sopa, mi gente?
Talk to me nice.
Hey, boo.
Welcome to the Black Language Podcast, where we talk about our people and our language, and we're talking black is anything said by a black person. I'm your host, Anansa, and I realized that I forgot to explain what I got going on in the logo. So the logo is lime green because my favorite color is green. And the lettering comes from the IPA, which is the International Phonetic Alphabet, not the beer. And this is kind of like the alphabet for linguists. So, you know, in school growing up, the alphabet that we learned, the A, B, C, D, E, F, G, when we see that written out, we typically see that, you know, like in elementary school classrooms written along the walls in like a straight line. Now, the IPA, the International Phonetic Alphabet, is actually written in a chart. So if you think about studying chemistry in high school, where you had the periodic table of elements, which displays all the elements and information like atomic number and other properties and stuff, that's kind of what the IPA is. So depending on where a letter is placed in the chart, that'll tell you certain properties of the sound, like how your mouth is shaped when you pronounce it. The IPA is supposed to represent all the sounds that humans make in language, and it does this through using letters and symbols known as diacritics. Now, the letters in the IPA probably look familiar to you a little bit. So if you know that the podcast is called the Black Language Podcast, when you look at the logo, you can kind of see the name, especially with the consonants. Now, this is because the IPA was constructed using many letters from the Latin and Greek alphabets by European scholars in the late 1880s. Now, this might leave you wondering about languages from other parts of the world and how they fit in. So the IPA went through many changes from the 1880s on, where linguists continued to add sounds from languages that are not European. But if this sounds like all those times in history where white men made decisions for other people, this is that. But here's my favorite part of the logo, though. So it's based on how I pronounce the Black Language Podcast. And so because of where I'm from, my age, you know, other parts of my identity, I do something called final consonant cluster reduction, which is a phonological feature, so a sound feature, that is found within variations of African-American language. Final consonant cluster reduction is when there are two consonants together at the end of the word and you drop that second consonant off. Now, this only occurs when the two consonants that are next to each other share voicing. Voicing is whether or not the sound is voiced or voiceless. So you know if a sound is voiced or voiceless if your vocal cords vibrate or not. A quick kind of test is to put your hand like on your throat right there on your vocal cords, and if you pronounce the S as in snake, like S, and the Z as in zebra, like Z, you can feel that the S is voiceless and the Z is voiced because the Z has that vibration. And so in the word podcast, the S and the T are both consonants that are at the end of the word and they're both voiceless. And so it's likely that I'll drop the T off. Other words that do this are friend. So in friend, you have the N and the D that are right there at the end of the word. They share voicing. They're both voiced. And so that D gets dropped off. And for me, at least, that's going to sound something more like friend. Another example is the word cold, like it's cold outside. So you have the L and the D that are right there at the end of the word, and they are both voice sounds. And so the D is going to drop off. And so that might sound something more similar to like cold. So for today's episode, I actually didn't anticipate doing another episode so quickly, but I just, you know, received a lot of support and I feel like I had some extra time, you know, between working and organizing. And so I wanted to continue to establish myself in this project. And I thought to myself, what could I talk about with some short notice? I immediately thought about my master's project, which was a paper I had to write to graduate. So at the time that I was brainstorming what to do for my master's project, my favorite piece of lingo was I so boom and the condensed versions so boom. And depending on where you're from, your age, other stuff about your identity, this might be something that you say. I know I was saying it all the time, and when it occurred to me that this is something that I could study, I was hyper vigilant. So whenever myself or someone else said it, my ears just flared up like a dog. And I knew that this was a phrase that people were talking about and already had some linguistic information about, because I had seen mad funny posts on the internet. Well, one of my favorites actually comes from Twitter, from OJ the Juice, and it says, who will make the black fairy tales that start with I so boom instead of once upon a time? There was another funny one I had seen on Facebook. I don't know who posted it. I didn't capture their name in the screenshot, but it's basically like an assignment given by a teacher, and the assignment says, please begin your story with a captivating hook, and then the kid writes I so boom. And then I was seeing and still seeing mad posts saying how you know a black person is about to tell a fire story, or how you know a New Yorker is about to tell a fire story. And in the comments, people would be replying saying, I so boom. So I knew that there was something here with I so boom and storytelling. And I ended up, you know, just scouring the internet, listening to all types of interviews, trying to hear people say, I so boom. And so, of course, when I'm looking for it, it's hard to find. But when I'm not looking for it, people's throwing around I so boom left and right. And so what I did is I like listened to like hours of Sway in the Morning interviews, Angie Martinez interviews, Breakfast Club interviews. And then I ended up listening to mad podcasts by black people, hoping someone was going to say, I so boom. And so I ended up actually finding, you know, like using like through some podcasts and through some Breakfast Club interviews, ended up finding multiple usages of I so boom. And what I ended up talking about in the paper is that I think I so boom belongs to this group of like words, phrases, utterances that are called pragmatic markers. Now, you could also call them discourse markers, which might sound more familiar to you, because I definitely think it's a more popular term, but also I've seen high school teachers teach discourse markers for writing. However, there are certain reasons why a linguist would choose to use discourse marker versus pragmatic marker. And from my understanding, that mostly has to do with their perspective towards how that, you know, word, phrase, or utterance functions. For me, I preferred using pragmatic markers, but look, I am not trying to have no beef with people who use discourse markers. I see that. I think it makes sense. At the time that I was doing my project, I had also just got done doing mad reading on relevance theory, so pragmatic marker felt right. But for this episode, I'm going to use discourse marker just because I feel like it's more accessible. So discourse markers help us do mad stuff, like mad stuff, and we use them all the time. We use them to show our attitude towards something, to start conversations, end conversation, organize what we're going to say, to help us introduce information, change topic, get people's attention. And so a discourse marker that I know I use all the time is the word so. So is a popular discourse marker. We use it to summarize information, change topics, and conversations. I know for a fact I've used it a ridiculous amount of times since this episode started, and I probably used it to change topics or summarize information. A big discourse marker too that is used often is the word like, and I know I use like all the time, and I think I use it as like, oh, I just said it again. But I think I use it as like a crutch for my stuttering. So years ago, I was doing some reading about stuttering. Like I had just learned what linguistics was, and I had actually seen, it was like a side view. I'm not sure if it was an MRI of someone speaking, but it was just basically you could kind of see like the internal parts of someone's like mouth, their throat. And, you know, I stuttered, and I remember asking my teacher, like, what does this look like for somebody who stutters? Like, is their tongue getting stuck somewhere? Like, what's happening? Because there is nothing, man, there is nothing worse than trying to say something and you can't get it out, and people are just looking at you and your head is doing all types of stuff and your eyes are twitching. But anyways, a while back I was doing some reading on stuttering, and I learned that people who stutter will use words, sounds, pauses, all sorts of things really to help us get through a sentence. And like is a word that is often used. But aside from that though, I think even if I didn't stutter, I would use like all the time, because like is a very common discourse marker. And there are some people who cannot stand it and they think it's ruining the English language, and they are repulsed by how informal it is and how careless it seems to be thrown around. It's actually not carelessly thrown around. There are rules about when you can and cannot use like. But it's also important to note that like is actually connected to young women's speech, and women's speech is often always criticized. I know for me here growing up in the States, you know, I've always heard things about, you know, speak like a lady, you know, a lady doesn't speak that way. And it's not just here. In other speech communities, there will be all these unwritten rules for what women can say and how they should say it. And what's interesting about all this is that it's typically young women who actually drive the language change. And here in the US, it's young Black women and Black queer youth who drive much of the language change. Anyways, though, like is such a useful discourse marker, and we use it when we're about to quote something someone else said, to introduce an example or explanation, before we give a number or quantity, and for so many other reasons. But one of the things that discourse markers do is serve as like a sick. I said like again. I'm gonna start that over. One of the things that discourse, you know, it's crazy because like if I was to go through this and kind of pick out all the times I use discourse markers, there's probably discourse markers all up and down what I'm about to say. But that's just because they're super useful. So one of the things that discourse markers do is they serve as like a signal to let the participant know what's happening in the discourse. And so a comparison that I like to make is to baseball and softball. So in softball, the pitcher and the catcher agree on a set of signals to represent pitches. So a pitcher might have a fastball, a curveball, a changeup, and each of those pitches will have their own signal so that in a game, catcher and the pitcher are able to communicate discreetly. So if the catcher shows a signal for a fastball, the catcher is then making the adjustments to expect a fastball to be thrown. And so it's important for the correct pitch to be thrown with the signal, because if the wrong pitch is thrown, then the catcher has to kind of readjust and they could totally be thrown off. So, you know, a fastball might come in, I don't know, 67 miles per hour, and someone's changeup might come in at like 55 miles per hour. And so you can see how like this might throw somebody off. So in language, we use discourse markers as signals to let participants know about the type of information that's coming next, or how what I'm about to say is connected to what I just said. So for example, if I'm reading my grocery list and I say lastly, you can infer that this will be the last thing on my list. If someone is speaking and I interrupt and say, actually, you can infer that I'm going to correct this person or provide an alternative viewpoint. And so discourse markers help us do many things. And I think that Boom plays that role in storytelling. Just from, you know, the two kind of examples, the funny examples of the social media posts that I mentioned about, you know, how people will start off their story with Boom, we know that stories can be introduced with Boom. And so when people use it to begin their story, I think it's serving as a signal to call attention to the storyteller. Kind of like, hey, heads up, pay attention to me, a story is about to come. What I would argue is that it's also helping the storyteller maintain the floor. So in conversation, you may or may not have noticed this, but we're constantly taking turns. And we are low-key actually competing with each other to try to talk. And no one really views this as like rude, because we're not interrupting each other. We're simply taking turns. And we know that there are certain things we have to do to make sure that we get a chance to speak. And so we will make sounds and use gestures and use phrases like Boom to help us maintain the floor and let people know, hey, look, we're going to be talking for a while, so don't speak so I can go ahead and tell my story. What I also want to add is that I'm curious about the usage of ISOBOOM when it's not used to begin to tell a story. So I've heard people say ISOBOOM when they're making some type of announcement, sharing like important information, or sometimes like sharing a plan. So for example, I could say, ISOBOOM, we're going to hit up the store and then mob out to the party. So that's obviously not telling a story, but I think it still functions in the same way where you're using it to call attention to yourself so you can provide some important information to the group or provide a plan, you know, so people are paying attention to you so you don't have to repeat yourself. What's also interesting about discourse markers is that they don't change if what I'm saying is true or not. So for example, if I begin a story like, ISOBOOM, yesterday I went to the mall at 6. Me using ISOBOOM doesn't make what I'm saying true, and it doesn't make what I'm saying untrue. And discourse markers have also been described as being optional. Now, when I say optional, I don't mean that we can just choose to never use discourse markers. I think if we did that, actually, our speech and our communication would just sound really robotic, because discourse markers are not useless. What I mean by optional is that whether or not I use ISOBOOM, like, my sentence is still grammatical, it's still understandable. But what the discourse marker does is it makes what I'm doing with the language more explicit. I think not using discourse markers would actually sound uncomfortable, because it would probably sound like really choppy and unconnected speech. For example, however is a discourse marker. And I could absolutely say something like, the green paint is pretty, however, I'm going to use gold. I could also say, the green paint is pretty, I'm going to use gold. And so from both of those kind of statements, you know, you can learn that I like green, but I'm going to use gold paint. But what the discourse marker allows me to do is show how these two sentences are connected to each other. So it's not confusing when I talk about green paint and then switch to talking about gold paint so suddenly. So when I think about ISOBOOM, I could absolutely begin a story without it. But I may have to use some other methods, possibly some more time-consuming methods, to get people's attention so I won't have to repeat the story, or repeat the story opening at least. People may also feel caught off guard if I don't give any warning before I launch into a 5-minute storytelling. Or I might have trouble trying to get through my story and kind of maintaining the floor, because people may be trying to interrupt me and not understanding that I'm telling a story because I didn't really make that explicit. Now, what I think is even wilder about ISOBOOM and SOBOOM is that we use it in the middle of storytelling, not just the beginning. And I felt like I was hyper vigilant towards anyone saying ISOBOOM and SOBOOM, I wasn't really aware that we use it in the middle of a storytelling until I started working on this project. And I spent, you know, those weeks and hours listening to these interviews. And when I heard somebody say SOBOOM in the middle of a storytelling, man, I threw my hands up, thought my project had just went completely out the window, because I was really set on explaining how ISOBOOM is used to launch a story, to begin a story. I had so much data examples from like Facebook posts and Twitter posts of people literally beginning Facebook statuses saying ISOBOOM, and then there's like 6 paragraphs on Facebook of them telling a story. And then I had the audio data from the interviews I was listening to, when people are, you know, being asked questions in the interview, then when they want to go in to tell a story, they begin with ISOBOOM or SOBOOM. And then they, you know, have their little 5-6 minutes to talk, tell their story. But of course, like any good linguist, I transcribe the data, you know, see if I could notice any patterns. And then I was reminded that discourse markers are also used, you know, to mark these boundaries in communications, to help us switch topics, to help us segue in and out of something. So that way our speech doesn't sound like that kind of choppy and sound like an unconnected series of sentences. So in storytelling, you have different sections that make up a narrative. You have the who, the what, the when, where, which we'll call the orientation. So if you're telling a story, this might be something like, yesterday around 3, me and my friends walked to the store. Then you have the section of the story where you give like the actual events that took place, basically the plot, that we'll call the complication. So this will be something like, we went inside the store, looked for chips, couldn't find any, didn't buy any, and left. Then you have the evaluation, where the narrator gives their kind of like their inner thoughts or attitude towards the story. This will be something like, I can't believe the store was sold out of chips. And then you have the resolution, which is basically the result of everything in the story. And so this might be something like, we ended up not getting chips and I was hungry for the whole day. So you have your orientation, complication, evaluation, resolution. Now, a narrator may not tell a story in that particular order, and that's totally fine. It's completely perfectly fine. They will probably bounce back and forth as they recall the story. And this is where I so boom and so boom come into play. So I know I said that I thought my project blew up in my face when people were using so boom in the middle of a story. But from the data that I had, it seemed that once the story started, people used so boom when they wanted to transition between different sections of the story. So when they wanted to transition between telling the orientation and getting into the complication, or when they wanted to, or when maybe they were given the complication, then they gave some, you know, evaluation, gave some comments about the story, and then they wanted to return back to the complication, giving the actual, you know, plot of the story. And so an example I have is from the infamous Soulja Boy interview on A Breakfast Club. And he was well into telling his story about this boxing match that was supposed to happen between him and Chris Brown. And so he's giving the events of his story, and then he enters the evaluation section where he provides his thoughts on the situation. And he says, I'm not finna fight Chris Brown for no million. That's too cheap, bro. Who you think I'm is? I'm Soulja Boy. You think this the alley-oop? So there, Soulja Boy is clearly providing his thoughts on the situation, talking about how people must not take him seriously, that he deserves a higher payment for his fight, you know, and then he says, y'all think this the alley-oop. So clearly he feels like he's being underestimated. So that's his evaluation. Then immediately he says, so boom, and follows with the actual events of his story by saying, I called Floyd. I was like, yo, CB, you want to fight me? Are you going to set it up for me? Floyd was like, I'll give you $7 million. So I think that's a pretty clear example of a narrator using so boom between two sections of their story. And if we think about what discourse markers help us do, one of those things is, you know, shift gears, change topics, segue, right? And I think in this Soulja Boy example, I so boom marks this boundary between sections of the story, and it does allow him to segue between different sections of the story. But also for the listener, right, discourse markers will help us follow the train of thought of the storyteller so that we were able to see how different pieces of their story are connected. I had two other examples of the same thing, and I freaked out because I was like, oh my God, like if so boom is really like this systematic within the language, like this is lit. And so, I mean, but of course, it was my master's project, so I didn't need to have, you know, a million examples. At the time, three was fine. And then I reflected on my own use and what I've heard. And I thought that it makes sense. Like, I don't think I've ever heard someone give the plot of their story, say so boom, and then return to giving the plot of the story. It kind of makes sense that while someone is giving the plot of the story, they may make a comment or two to reflect on what's happening in the story. And then they use so boom to return back to the plot, or maybe return to the resolution. And I think we've actually heard an example of so boom gone wrong. And it's from Tekashi 6ix9ine's interview on The Breakfast Club back in 2018. I feel like that was another infamous interview because people were making jokes and talking about the interview. I remember like Twitter making fun of his use of so boom. And so there's actually a YouTube video that's called, quote, Tekashi 6ix9ine interview, but it's awkward, so boom, end quote. And I think it's just, you know, interesting that something about his usage of so boom just felt awkward for people. Felt like he was saying it maybe a bit too much or maybe throwing it around. And I remember those jokes on Twitter, so I did go back and just search Tekashi and boom and scroll down to 2018. And I definitely saw all those same jokes where people were kind of just, you know, teasing and making jokes about his usage of so boom. And what I find particularly interesting, actually, about the Tekashi 6ix9ine situation is that, well, first, I don't even know how he has a career right now, given that he's admitted to committing sexual assault. But also, he's come up in conversations about cultural appropriation as a rapper who is not Black and says the N-word. And so I find it interesting that people have noticed his inability to use this piece of African-American vernacular English like a native speaker. Like, I find it interesting that people feel that there's some kind of awkwardness about his use. Because actually, like, now that I think about it, I wish I counted the number of times that he said "so boom" and the number of times that Soulja Boy says "so boom." Because Soulja Boy says "so boom" like a fair number of times. Like going back to my paper, like there's like at least 4 or 5 times where he says "so boom." And Tekashi, I think Tekashi definitely probably said it more times. But, you know, Soulja Boy is also using it very frequently, but people don't think that there's something weird about it. And so this kind of reminds me of like when we have seen corporations and non-black celebrities and like movie writers, TV writers try to use, you know, African-American language and fail because they don't understand that there's kind of an intricate way that things work, just like any language, right? And so what this tells me is that so boom isn't just something that can be thrown around frivolously when we speak. We have an intuition about how it can be used. And I definitely want to keep an eye out for so boom and to see how it changes and how it continues to be used, because I actually don't know too much about discourse markers among Black people besides the usage of discourse markers in the Black church. And so I'm going to end by saying that I actually wanted my podcast to be called ISO Boom. And I think after this episode, you could probably tell why. Like, it's used to introduce things and change topics. Like, I feel like that's what you do on a podcast. You introduce things and have various topics. But there's already multiple podcasts called ISO Boom. And what's cool is that they all spell I differently. So I feel like that's, you know, like a shout out to the creativity of Black people and the limitations of the English alphabet. What's also really dope actually about ISO Boom, which we didn't get into today, and something I hope to learn more about, is like the connection between, like, you know, discourse markers and gesture. Gesture actually plays a huge role in language. Much of what we communicate, we can communicate with body posture, gaze, our hands. And so there's one podcast that's called ISO Boom. I forget how they spell it though. But it's literally a picture of like some hands. You got some nails on there, you know, some rings, and the hands are clasped together. And I think that is so funny because I think there is kind of like this thing, like this intuition again that we have about someone saying ISO Boom and then clasping their hands together. And actually, when I was looking on the internet, just, you know, searching up ISO Boom, I found multiple memes where it was like pictures of people clasping their hands and someone goes to make a joke and will comment on the picture ISO Boom. There's actually this one picture. I'm probably going to upload it somewhere on the social media, where this is dude, he's wearing this green jacket, and the green jacket has like 5 clasped hands going up and down the jacket, which sounds really funny, but the caption to the picture is literally ISO boom, ISO boom, ISO boom, ISO boom, to represent each hand that is clasped to another hand. And so that'll definitely be something cool to think about, get into, notice, you know, if you or your friends, are y'all clasping your hands when y'all say ISO boom? Are y'all saying ISO boom to talk about stories or to talk about other things? And so that being said, thanks for rocking out with me. I'll talk to y'all soon. One.
All right. I'm back to ask for you to please rate, comment, subscribe to the podcast, share it on whatever platforms you're on if you feel moved to. Also, you can find this podcast on Instagram and Twitter at Black Lang Pod. That's BLACK Lang LANG Pod POD.